on maynard.com.au. Hey, you! Good morning, listener. Here I am walking down on a fine Sydney sunny morning to interview Mr. Tim Ferguson. His book, Carry a Big Stick, has just come out, and for the first time ever, Tim has invited me to his place to interview him. This has never happened. I've known Tim for many years. It's never happened. So let's go see what happens when I get inside, folks, hey?
Maynard.
May I come in, sir?
I will press the button.
Ooh. Yeah. This is nice. This is very homely. I've just entered the inner sanctum of Tim Ferguson's house. As I said, known him for many years, never been invited to his house. Now I can see why. This is like a Playboy mansion, Tim.
I like to live humbly. As you can see, how big is my handmade TIE fighter?
I'm surrounded by artworks and they're very abstract. And of course, he does have the world's biggest collection of Star Wars paraphernalia. What a DVD library. In fact, it's kind of what you'd expect, people.
Of course, I can't show you my underwear drawer because I'm having the whole thing cleaned. I just said, take the whole thing and bring it back later.
I'm all settled down on the Tim Ferguson couch, which over the years would have seen some action, I imagine, Tim.
I try to forget what I've done on this couch so that I can get jobs that will help me entertain the Australian people, Maynard.
A big screen TV here. What's the thing that's normally seen on that big screen TV?
I like Foxtel. It's just got so many channels. Whenever you're bored with one, which only takes a few moments, you move to the next one, which will only take a few moments until you move to the next one and you can cycle through all day.
I have actually had time during their ad breaks to forget what I've been watching because they put so many ads on now.
Well, and the ads are always telling you about all the other shows. Like, seriously? I don't need to be sold Foxtel. I just bought Foxtel.
You've had a career on there, as featured in Carry a Big Stick. You had the Foxtel part of your career. I actually wrote some dialogue for you. The Space Cadets show.
Oh, yes. Space Cadets was so much fun. And I saw a bit of it was on YouTube, someone sent to me, which was you and me, we were having a chat.
And an actual rocket scientist, and we were talking about the invention of Velcro, which I've been told we got completely wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't NASA at all, wasn't it? Just some fabric specialist. And, you know, that's one of those myths that NASA starts to help it pay for itself. And, like, when they said we invented coffee, I was sucked in completely.
I've always thought that a science fiction comedy variety music show, it was always the go. I was doing something like that on Fox 2 when it first started, Planet FX.
And, of course, a quick look at Sputnik the horse as well. Here's Sputnik. Look at that. Wow, that's the psychedelic drug induced skivvy. Sputnik went up into space wearing a black skivvy and came back wearing that.
But the Sci-Fi Channel doesn't do any local content like that.
Well, and if you look at Supernova, the enormous success, you would think you just have an evening, at least one show, where you say, everybody in a costume, get into this shed, we're going to have an evening of, and everybody's dressed like, you know, Spider-Man. I think it'd be fun and sexy.
A lot of Australia didn't get to see your Channel 31 show that you had in Melbourne. You want to explain what that was?
It was called With Tim Ferguson, which I had to explain the acronym for With Tim Ferguson, and even then they were scratching their heads. It was for the Victorian state election, and all I wanted to do was stop the Greens getting elected just to see if I could. Nothing against the Greens, they're perfectly nice people, although they're eating themselves alive at the moment, as left-wing political parties do. I just thought, wouldn't it be fun just to pick on people with whom I agree? Isn't that more fair than picking on the Tories or picking on the Labour Party?
We're coming to you live from traditional Wurundjeri land, and that means absolutely nothing to our audience, who are a group of property developers. Good evening.
And it worked. Yeah, the Greens didn't get elected, and I feel a little bit of guilt, but we told some great Greens jokes. Like, you know, how many Greens does it take to change a light bulb? They're not going to change the light bulb.
I'm in Tim Ferguson's kitchen now, where I can see a vast array of unwashed plates and glasses. But Tim's in the other room doing an interview with 5AA in Adelaide, where he suspects that the person interviewing him has not actually read his book. Let us listen to Tim's side of the conversation.
This thing, multiple sclerosis. Why stop at one sclerosis, I said. If I'm going to have them, I want them all. So for me, it just means most of the time that my leg doesn't cooperate. So I walk around with a big stick and it just means I move a bit more slowly. But I never had a dancing career, Leon. No, I point blank refuse. Dancing with the Sticks is a show that I just can't seem to get off the ground.
Well, Tim Ferguson, you were just on Adelaide Commercial Talkback Radio there. You've done a few interviews for Carry a Big Stick. Can you tell by now whether the person's actually read the book or not?
Normally, I can tell if they've not read the book because they will say things like, it's quite thick, it's quite a thick book, there's a lot in it. And you'll say, well, actually, no, lots of pages with very big typing.
But that makes it good for people to read. I like big typing. But
another sign is quite often where they will read the quotes on the back. So Paul McDermott is he speaks very highly of you. Well, I'll tell you what Paul McDermott says on the back, the little bugger. He says, in no man alive is the line between idiot and savant so indistinct. Well, thank you very much, little fluffy man.
I've actually contacted Paul McDermott to try and get a quote. An internal email to Richard Feidler bounced within the ABC system, so I don't know. He still works for the ABC, I assume.
It's impossible to get a hold of Richard. You can only speak to Richard via TalkBack because he's so busy. He's got to read the weather, he's got to tell us the traffic, and he has to talk to all those important people. On the back of my book, Richard says, none of this is true. Tim wasn't even there. Well, look, it's a memoir. I can't really remember if I was in some of these situations.
Well, one of the ones that comes to mind, and you said to, even to this day is still disputed, was perhaps your final appearance on The Big Gig where you were all assassinated and Richard Feidler was wearing a boa tie. And when the explosive in his chest to propel the blood pack went off when he was assassinated, it also propelled the tie pin into his eye.
It certainly did. And as we were bringing Richard down to the nurse's station, we went past reception. Richard, of course, was screaming like a little girl who's just dropped her party cake and, of course, had blood all over himself and guts, fake guts hanging out. And, of course, the receptionists were a little bit concerned. And Paul said, don't worry, it's just a flesh wound. Now, Richard disputes this. He says he wasn't screaming at all, but he was screaming. He was screaming. It was just like, yeah, 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 yeah. And if he contradicts this, Maynard, if he goes on the ABC and contradicts me, well, I will say, and I will say it here and now, that is a lie. It is a base lie. It is a fabrication. It is made up in fairy tale land.
In fact, this is where I will pause in the show to insert a quote from Paul McDermott about you now.
I'm in a three-ton truck. My brother's on the nod. He's got the noddies. Get off the fucking... I love Tim Ferguson. He's a powerful, emotional being. He's gorgeous. He's one of the most handsome men I've ever seen in my entire life. Tim's a genius, a wonderful, warm, compassionate, sexy, vibrant human being.
Well, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I made Paul. That sort of thing, it kind of hurts me for him to be so vague about how he feels. And I will go so far as to say that is also another lie from an all-star.
And we'll pause for a moment here to get a quick quote about you, Tim Ferguson, from Richard Feidler.
He's a man of infinite patience, charm. He also has this ability to pull jokes out of absolutely nowhere and make them just somehow materialise in the middle of the stage. You've got to wait for a while for them to happen, of course, too long at times, but he has that extraordinary, insane comic genius that allows him to do such things.
I made Richard. I made him what he is today. If I hadn't stopped and said, hey, mate, play the guitar and I will entertain the people, he would still be the most promising pre-real estate agent in Canberra.
Oh, there we go. Page 78 of Carry a Big Stick. Tell us about Robert, the mime artist who never was.
Oh, man, the Pete Best of the Doug Anthony All-Stars. Now, that guy had talent. Robert Piper played the flute. He sang, he was cute, he was daffy, he was just an affable guy. But one day he said, I've got to leave, I'm going to go and live in Paris. And because it was the 80s, he said, I'm going to mime school. And we thought that was cool.
We even had a trained mime artist in the Castanet Club. I don't think you could have an anarcho-syndicalist smallest collective performance group in the 80s without having a mime artist that had trained in Paris.
Well, that's true. You needed that sort of cred, someone who could make something out of nothing. Things turned out pretty well for Robert. He ended up being Bill Clinton's PA at the United Nations.
Wow.
So, yeah, to go from mime school...
You are talking personal assistant and not PA, where Bill would say something and he would mime. He would mime the free trade agreement.
Bill would say things like, get me another one. And Robert would, you know, shamefacedly go and get another one.
Was Richard the one that replaced Robert, or was Paul the one that replaced Robert?
You could never replace someone with that much talent and genius, but we did go on.
It's certainly been wasted on you lot. The President Clinton's PA with the Doug Anthonys, really.
Yeah, I know. You know, we filled the giant gap with something much smaller, which was Paul McDermott.
Tell me how you found him. He's a fairly unique talent, and he's even harder to corral into the right area. How did you get him in?
Paul was working with a trio of people called Gigantic Fly. One of them was a beautiful woman, Jacinta Legge Wilson. The other was a guy called Paul Heumann, who was another artist like Paul. We just noticed that he could sing, and so we said, can you sing? He said, oh, I don't know if I can sing. Pick a song. He said, oh, I think I'd like Charles Aznavour's She. I think I can sing that. So we started playing it, and Paul, of course...
Was Paul taking hormone therapy at the time, the way you describe his voice there?
He's still taking hormone therapy. You should see the beard. He looks like a Wookiee. Well, he started singing, and he sang like an angel on a bourbon bender.
She may be the beauty of the beast, may be the famine of the feast, may turn his day into a hell of sheep.
And that was it. And so we grabbed a hold of Paul and away we went. But really, we all should have gone to the UN.
Look, it's so hard to cover an entire lifetime in one book. How did you actually cut bits out? How did you edit parts out of your own life?
I decided that the book would work best if it was not so much an autobiography, but as a rationalisation of everything I've done. In a way, it's a book of excuses. It starts with, it's my family's fault, and ends with, oh, it's my fault.
And one of the great lines in there, and I guess it's common to a lot of performers that are in the middle of, I used to call it life on 11, where everything was just going on at once. You said you were too busy doing things to take any moment for self-reflection.
Oh, yeah. The idea of when people say you've got to learn and grow as a person is great if you're sitting around and if you've grown as a person, you never have to do anything. The only way to grow as a person is to ignore growing and just start doing. And eventually, you know, in the rubble, you can say, who am I? And like Zoolander, you know, the answer will be provided hopefully by someone beautiful who's not wearing much.
Look, I'm just wondering if you could read this paragraph from page 184, because I want a question at the end of the paragraph.
We were all set to win the Edinburgh Festival's biggest award. Everyone believed it was our year after building ever bigger audiences. Now, in the end, it all came down to a bunch of judges reportedly having a vehement argument. Two judges truly believed that the Doug Anthony All-Stars were fascists. They claimed we wore uniforms and chanted Viva la Führer and didn't openly condemn Hitler in our song, I Want to Be a Mexican Hitler. It probably didn't help that Paul and I did a dance that combined our arm movements to resemble a swastika. It was quite an arresting dance. We believed our intentions were clear, that the Nazis were gutless chickens who escaped justice, therefore inspiring others to follow their evil dictates. We certainly didn't feel the need to apologise for making this point in the song.
What I want to ask you, Tim, is how do you think that you and Paul doing a dance that makes a swastika would equate to people thinking the Nazis were gutless chickens who escaped justice? I don't see the connection between those two things. Maybe the Perrier Judds just felt the same.
It was a mockery of Nazism. If you have a tall guy and a short guy forming a swastika with their arms, singing what had to be a ludicrous Mexican song based upon the harmonies of Brazil, you have to say there is some belittlement of the viciously stupid idea of Nazism.
South America, here I come. I want to be a Mexican Hitler. Viva la Cuba.
Mussolini in a white sombrero. Viva la Fuhrer! Viva la Fuhrer! Here comes the new law and the new order. Reichstag's burning south of the border.
But people just thought, because we were wearing uniforms and not apologising, which comedy should never do, that we must be fascists. Of course, we were very conservative, but we weren't that bad.
You actually give a name to your style of parody here in the book. What is it called, that style of parody?
Mexican Hitler was representative satire. This was attacking something by becoming that thing. So, like Stephen Colbert attacks Republicans by being a Republican, in inverted commas.
At the time, what was the reaction in the Edinburgh Festival? Because you guys, and I'm not overstating it at all, whenever you guys were in town there, and I went to the Edinburgh Festival twice while you guys were there, you guys were the talk of the town. If people hadn't seen you, they were talking about people that had seen you. If they weren't being outraged by you, they knew someone that had been. You were assert to get the Perrier Award, which, let me tell you, is a huge award. It's the one everyone tries to get at the Edinburgh Festival in 93. You just slipped out. You're definitely sure it was this song that did it for you? People just, let me get this right. A comic judge took a joke the wrong way.
Yeah, they took it the wrong way. And I was always suspicious of prizes anyway, because I thought our job as comedians is not to get consensus. It is to make people laugh whether they want to or not. And we were supposed to be contrarians. So to get nine English people all agreeing that, oh yes, I think the All-Stars really have really come a long way and they should be given a prize, actually kind of offended me. So I was more happy with the cred we got from the outrage of people when we lost.
And typical Doug Anthony All-Star arrogance in your quote in the book at the time, you said, a runaway train doesn't need a green light.
Right, yeah, we didn't need anybody's permission. Of course, we immediately went to the Donmar warehouse at the heart of London and did a rock and roll season. Richard got so excited, he broke his arm and we kept going. We didn't need a whole bunch of middle-class inner-city dweebs to tell us, yes, we approve the Doug Anthony All-Stars messages in general. They gave it to some commo lefty nitwit who went and won. And, you know, good luck to him. And he got poxed by having to buy a big house.
You do put a lot of your comic reason for being in the business down to the fact that many times in your life you were the new kid in a new school.
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, and the same thing with the All-Stars. We were the new kids and we kept coming back with new shows that kept us being the new kids. And when I moved into network television, I was the new kid again.
Everyone talks about Don't Leave Home Without Your Toothbrush. It was a big budget show on Channel 9. As far as I know, did it only run one season? Like, it wasn't something that was on for a long time, but everyone knows about it.
Oh, yeah, everyone carried on about it. And, yeah, we burnt brightly. We did one season. It was a long one, but eventually we spent all the money in the network.
This question, everything rests upon it. Angiamo is the name of an Italian restaurant in the Hilton Hotel on Paradise Road. But what does Angiamo mean? Let's eat or let's go?
Let's go!
Are you sure about that? For a trip to Las Vegas? Are you right? Are you sure?
It was the most expensive game show in Australian TV history, the most expensive TV show outside of the Olympic broadcast. It was, talk about throwing money at the problem. We spent all the money.
And you were on contract to Channel 9 for a very long time. It's almost like they were hiding you away, Tim. Were you working on the Toothbrush Project for a long time, or they honestly didn't know what to do with you when you're on the contract there?
After Toothbrush, they really didn't know. They knew they couldn't afford to do another one. Mr. Packer was freaking out about how much money they'd blown. Then they thought, well, what do we do with this square peg?
Did you actually meet Mr. Packer?
Oh, Mr. Packer, yeah, and he was all right. You know, the guy's a billionaire and they're very charming people. You don't make $1 billion by being obnoxious. You know, I quite enjoyed my brief conversations with him. As terrifying as he was, it's like Molly Meldrum said, he's a big bear. But, of course, you have to remember that bears in bad moods also have their claws.
And also within the homosexual subculture, bear means something completely different. Can you see a TV project for yourself in the near future? Is there something you'd like to work on, or would you like to go into radio, or are you happy taking things as you choose them? Because, you know, you've got to take things a bit on your terms these days.
Yeah, I could do a TV show, you know, I mean, I just wouldn't be running up and down stairs. My brain works to a degree. I still have a modicum of a sense of humour, and I was taught by the best people in the world how to host things, so I just haven't really tried because I lack a lot of faith in television executives to be anything but terrified. And I don't want to scare them too much, poor darlings. It's all about timing, and eventually someone will wake up and say, you know, this smoking ruin around us needs something. It needs someone who knows what they're doing, someone who's old but new. And once they've gone through John Burgess, they will come to me, Maynard.
And how do you handle rejection within the industry? You've done Unreal TV, you've done Toothbrush, you've done many successful projects. But like a lot of people, most of the stuff gets rejected. How do you handle that? You've always been an arrogant guy, but is that just a front?
Of course it's a front. You throw your brain into everything and you say, this is going to work. You have to operate on the basis that you would have to be a moron to say no to this idea. And then when someone does say no to the idea, you go through this kind of, I make myself feel good by blaming it all on them. So it doesn't really impact me emotionally. I just say, this is just another instance whereby a television executive doesn't have vision.
Does that mean you're blaming the voters of New South Wales for only 3,000 of them voting for you in the Senate recently?
Well, those 3,000 who voted for me could have voted twice if they'd really thought about it. So I think the people who voted for me let me down, not the people who didn't.
And what about this Liberal Democrat guy that's got into the Senate?
He is going to be good for comedy. Anyone who's trying to get guns to be in everybody's hands and also legalise euthanasia is trying to send Australia a message. Is Nana really needing to be around anymore?
And of course, there's been a few moves that way in Tasmania recently with the Senate shake-up. Well, what are your moves about that? A very serious issue, but one you must think of because you're thinking about disability issues all the time. What's your actual feeling on euthanasia, Tim?
I was talking with my brother about this morning.
Well, guys, is he not well?
No, we were just saying, you know, how are you feeling? I said, I could kill someone. The trouble with legalising euthanasia is, as everybody recognises, it's the same thing as the Americans experience with legalised capital punishment. Even if you do agree with capital punishment, that one mistake, the one time you get it wrong, invalidates whatever you wanted to. And of course, euthanasia is the same. The one time where someone loses their life because of, you know, the manipulations of others, surely that invalidates everybody being able to have the choice of ending their life. Now, everybody knows someone who's in the process of dying or has died. It's a very difficult issue, but I still have my doubts that we can trust every single person with a loaded gun like euthanasia.
Do you think there's any system in the world where they've put enough checks and balances in place to even come close, somewhere like the Netherlands or something?
Yeah, everybody talks about the Netherlands, but what does Joey say in Friends? You know, the Netherlands is where Peter Pan and Wendy live. I don't think we can use the Netherlands as an example for anything anymore. It's what happens to Greens when they can't stand living in Australia anymore. We've got to come up with something. I have no idea what, which is why when I'm a senator, I'll decide.
There's another go-round in a couple of years if you're up for it.
Oh, I'm definitely up for it. We've been planning it already. I think I'll run in either WA or Tasmania.
Because of the senatorial quota allocation.
And also the pleasant weather.
We're going through the book here. We were just at a page 184. Page 200. Which I've simply written The Fall. This was in 1993 when you were playing the Cochrane Theatre near Cambridge Circus in the UK and you went to get out of bed. You want to tell us what happened, Tim?
Yeah, I went to get out of bed and I just sort of slumped out of bed. I went to stand up and I fell over again. I realised that the left side of my body, it was kind of like it was cramped. It wasn't sore. All the muscles were switched on. So it was like I was flexing my arm, flexing my left side of my ribs, flexing, you know, my whole leg.
But you weren't getting feedback. Is that what was not happening?
No, nothing was obeying orders. So I thought, this is very odd. But I said to the guys, my leg isn't working, but we keep doing the shows. Everybody said, you don't have to. you shouldn't do the shows. And I said, well, it's not sore. Whatever it is will go away. And after a couple of weeks, it did.
What was happening at that stage? Was that the first initial synapse that wouldn't fire? Was that what was going on there?
It was my brain, my tiny little brain. Since I was, you know, about 19, I'd had these little weird, little unrelated symptoms that would happen in my body. Buzzing, ringling, stiffening, zapping and stinging too. And I thought, this is all because of the bourbon. And it's all because of the lifestyle. But this was the first time that the shark fin of multiple sclerosis actually cut through the water, and there it was, this thing. So I swiftly went into denial because we were in the middle of a high-powered West End season. That was it.
When did the official word come out for you? When did you actually go to a doctor and do something about it? And they went, well, it looks like this is what this could be.
Well, I went to a doctor and he just said, stop whatever it is you're doing.
You know, well, that's pretty good advice. I mean, anyone who lived the Doug Anthony lifestyles or saw you guys, well, that's not bad advice. But then again, there was no time for self-reflection, let alone a pop off to a specialist.
And also, I felt physically, in terms of fitness, I was prime. I was doing two shows a night. That was a four-hour aerobic workout every evening. I felt perfectly healthy, so I thought we'll just keep going. And then, you know, but then it happened again, and it was getting worse. It was getting impossible to manage. I only actually went and got an MRI long after the All-Stars when I thought, well, nobody's looking. I might go and ask a doctor, what's wrong with all my different body parts, my eyes, my knees, my hands, why can't I feel hands when I'm shaking them? Why isn't my face moving? And he said, here, get into the MRI. No, go on, get in, Freddie, get in. It's not claustrophobic. Silence! So I got in this MRI and it wasn't claustrophobic at all. And the guy showed me a picture of my brain, which is a very, very small picture. And he said, yeah, those little white spots are not cocaine residue. I said, well, I think they are. He said, no, they're clusters of tiny scars.
Do you have an MRI on a regular basis? Can you see how it's progressing or you just don't want to do that?
Oh, I've had a couple which they made me get at two-year intervals. And then I thought, look, okay, I've got MS. What do you want? You want to see how it's progressing for your own studies, your own research? Yes, we do. Well, no, because it is. It's a little bit claustrophobic in there. We have to talk like a drag queen.
It's a bit like a performance thing too, isn't it? Going in on the slide and that sort of thing. And then you're in there doing your solo show and you come out. There should be a little curtain you go through.
there should, although it felt a little bit Soylent Greenish as well.
What is your favourite sci-fi movie? I know you love Star Wars, but you got something beside that?
You know, I'm one of the few people who like the very first Star Trek movie, all 12 hours of it.
And the very long 10-minute scene where Spock takes a ride into the middle of V'ger on that backpack with the now very dated effects.
Apparently, Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner both went to sleep during the film. Yes, at the premiere.
They did. One of my favourite movie moments from any Star Trek movie is, I think, when they're getting the Enterprise back together or something, and there's a transporter accident. Kirk tries to pull this guy back, and he dematerialises as a bunch of mush on the transporter floor. And there's a look on Shatner's face, not of panic or that someone's just died, but there's a true whoops look on his face. And it's like he was given the wrong directorial cue. Okay, we're playing this one for comedy, Bill. It was very much a whoops moment. I challenge people to have a look at that and think that Shatner's thinking whoops.
I remember that moment. It does seem to be sort of underplaying.
Yes.
You know, sending someone back as a bucket of mush.
Underplayed is not a word you normally associate with William Shatner.
No, that's true. Even the wig is doing all of its work.
Page 330. Wow, I must have been very, very deep in thinking when I wrote this. I said, how do you keep the sadness out? Do you welcome it and kill it with kindness? Because there's a lot of sadness around everyone's life. And have you kept the sadness out?
It's not really a conscious choice. I think having experienced just a childhood of constant change, going to 9 schools, having to make new friends, having to forget the other ones, something happened in my psychology which set in place this confidence that whatever's happening now, no matter how good or bad it is, don't worry. In a month, it will be gone and you'll be on a whole other planet with other problems. I don't worry about sadness at all. I figure that passes too.
And there's a lovely photo in the book of your lovely second wife.
Oh, yes, Stephanie Dawn Mills, Canadian. I went to Canada. I found the most beautiful Canadian woman I could and spent months begging Stephanie, please, don't you know who I was, I said.
What was it that finally clinched her to come and live here with you?
Oh, just my persistence. Well, I actually met Stephanie in the Gold Coast, the most romantic place that you can.
Oh, what schoolies work or something, was it?
It's like movie schoolies, which is the movie convention. Oh. Everybody there and they're all, you know, drunk in the streets and shouting at traffic and getting arrested and starting fights. I said, Stephanie, you know, you're terrific. She was like, oh, thank you very much. You're very kind. Then I had to track her down in Melbourne and said, please come to dinner. Oh, you're very kind, but right now I'm really very busy. And I seriously had to pester her a lot until finally she said, okay, we'll go to dinner. And man, I was about as charming as I've ever been in my life. Oh, I was feigning interest in another person better than anybody. This was as sincere as I could pretend to be.
Tim, I noticed that I wasn't in the book. Kerri-Ann Kennelly's in there, but I'm not in there.
Well, when one is writing about Buddha, one doesn't mention Buddha. You are the ambience that makes the book possible. There's no point in saying Maynard this, Maynard that, because you'd be on every page.
I'd forgotten that you did actually do a live cross from wherever you were in England once a week to the Today Show when Kerri-Ann Kennelly was hosting it with Steve Lieben there.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me and hold me like you'll never let me go. On a jet plane, don't know if we'll take off again. All the mortars that they threw, can't touch the flying kangaroo.
Qantas, your safety record is still 100%.
That and the big gig have been the two defining moments that really kicked your popularity together, those two things?
Certainly it helped in Australia. I was very keen for Australians to know what we were doing over there. We were, you know, we were on TV in Britain and I wanted everybody to know it. And there was no internet. There were no pigeons that had that sort of wing strength and stamina. And I was in love with Liz Hayes. She's just the most wonderful TV presenter. She's the perfect woman. We had lunch with her and she called up and said, you know, you guys, why don't you come on the Today Show once a week? And she said, you can torture Steve all you like. And so we did. Every week, Steve Lieben would have a little song. My favourite was, Steve, 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 let your hair hang down. Stevie's hair was never going to hang anywhere.
And you said that he would, like, sit there quietly tapping a pencil on the heel of his shoe while he waited for the item to be over.
With a pained and patient smile of a priest watching his flock who had gone astray yet again.
You get through to the end. I think the last line is, the adventure continues. The adventure continues. Are we going to have another book or two? Because reading through this, I'm going, oh, I bet you there's a bit more about Canberra there. Well, I bet you there's a bit more about the Doug Anthonys. And is the problem the fact that everyone's still alive at this stage? You can't really do a tell-all book in any way at this point.
Yeah, assassins are being put in place is all I can say, which will help with the next story of my life, not only carrying a big stick, but probably pushing two wheels downhill fast will probably be the next one, and then lying on a big bed, and the final one, staring at the ceiling.
How hard was it to get published? Did you self-publish, or did you just turn up and say, come on, I've got some ideas?
The publishers are Hachette, who were Australia's second biggest publishing house, and it was they who came to me and said, you must have a story to tell. Why don't you write a book? I hadn't even considered writing my tell-all memoir at that stage. So I spent a year wringing my hands, bumping into walls, muttering, and then out popped a book.
Let's go to the internet where we know all the great questions are. I posed that I was interviewing you today and could people ask me some questions to ask you. Ambrosia X asks, has mankind been using alien technology?
Of course they have. Where do you think Velcro came from? And Vegemite and cats. The aliens are with us and some of them are reading the news. I'm not mentioning names, but you know who you are.
Karen Devonport asks, when is your next book coming out, Tim?
Fairly swiftly, I hope. I'm writing an adventure book for young teens. It's called Wish Hunter, and it's about a young woman protagonist dealing with wicked, wicked people in a land where magic will not save her.
Not about Christine Milne, is it? So it's hard to know, Tim, when you say something, because I've always had a rule, always take the Doug Anthonys, any of them, Paul, Richard, at face value, because it doesn't matter if they're lying, because it's still good entertainment. We can't tell anymore, because you lied about being in Batman, you lied about being good friends with Jack Nicholson, and goodness knows what else.
I'm looking at erotic literature. It's so hard, though, because you run out of metaphors. You know, as somebody read some erotic literature I'd written and said, oh, it's very funny. And I said, it's not supposed to be funny. Well, it is funny. It's just those pesky metaphors. Apparently, you know, pussy is not just a cat. It means something else. I don't get it.
Marius Vanderlube asks, does it hurt when I do this?
Well, of course not. Your name is Vanderlube.
That's just Twitter. Let's go to Facebook. Andrew Ragg wants to know about the Donkey Boy reference once again.
At high school, I got lumbered with this. What can I say? When you're a kid in first year at high school, it's a burden. When you're a grown-up, it's less of a burden.
Scott Anderson writes, in a fairly serious question here, which is unlike internet, isn't it?
It's unlike Facebook.
Scott Anderson writes, I'd like to hear something about Duntroon and possibly Tim's father. I've ordered my book and looking forward to it, and he doesn't want to hear about Donkey Boy, and he especially doesn't want to hear about Paul McDermott.
Well, it's good to rule out topics. So you're okay with dance hall and talking about Muriel's wedding. So that's good. Duntroon, of course, is the military college in Canberra. It's a place that trains young men.
How long were you there, all day?
I can't actually talk about my experience at Duntroon. I'm not allowed to talk about it. In terms of my father, he was a wartime correspondent who, after this and that, ended up being David Hill's minder at the ABC, quietly being the deputy boss of the ABC, the quiet man with the stick.
David Hill was a managing director with a bit of a sense of humour. He was on when I was doing the Triple J Breakfast Show, and he would do IDs for me. I'll play one of them now.
Hi, this is David Hill, Managing Director of the ABC. Maynard, son, lift your game or you're out of here in 10 minutes.
I can't imagine the current Managing Director doing that with the Triple J Breakfast Show.
I was unaware that Triple J is still on the air. I think it's great that a government station for young people is regarded as cool by its average audience of people in their mid-40s. I love it when young people come up to me and say, I listen to Triple J, you know, the government station. It's really cool. I think that's just so heartening that kids have the trust in the Abbott government when they're listening to their radios.
Everyone likes to react against their parents. Is part of your act in the early days a reaction against the parents? Was your dad a little bit of a left-leaner, so that's where the anti-left humour comes? Or was he completely the opposite? He was a bit of a right-wing guy.
Oh, Dad was very much on the left. He was probably the one most responsible for making the ABC a predominantly, you know, as people say, a slightly left-wing affair. He came back from Vietnam with Mike Carlton, with Peter Luck, with Peter Couchman, with Bill Peach, Gerald Stone, and they all came back and said, what will we do now? How about we invent current affairs on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation? That's why, you know, it's still a little bit lefty.
I was recently at a strategic planning presentation for the ABC, ABC Radio. Would you have any idea how to do this, Tim? If someone said, Tim?
Well, I'd just sack everybody first.
Put a broom through the place.
That's right. You've got to act like a Soviet if you want to change a Soviet.
You realise immediately with your first move you've just burnt a lot of the human resources budget because you'd have to retrench everybody, which would cost a fortune. So you've just spent a lot of money on retrenchments, Tim. How do you get new people at a low amount and still spend the same amount of money?
Oh, you don't get new people. That's the thing. If you look at the way North Korea does it, there are only 5 people who run the network, who talk on the network, who make up the news for the network. So that's one thing I'd try. The other thing is, well, basically to break out of the pattern, whatever the pattern is, to try stuff that ordinarily would be argued against. And not allow committees to design anything, because what's that thing about a committee designs a horse and it ends up a camel? Leave it to one person who knows what they're doing, for example, Maynard.
Well, what you're saying there about trying a whole bunch of new things, this was a position that Channel 9 was in very much when you were there doing Don't Leave Home Without Your Toothbrush. You've got an ageing audience that love what you're doing, and you've got to get a younger audience in without disenfranchising the older audience, and Toothbrush was a good attempt at that. How do you do that? How do you get fresh stuff in without losing, as the ABC likes to refer to them, your rusted-on listeners?
The rusted-on listeners are closer to death, and so you don't have to worry about them. It's worth noting that the average age of the ABC TV viewer is 70. Let's get real, people. Seriously, let's get real.
I'm not going to hear a word against new tricks. I will not hear a word against that show.
Oh, I've never heard of that. I'm way too young.
Well, it's Dennis Waterman's greatest project.
Oh, God, he's terrific.
He even sang the theme this time around again.
If you want to get young people, then you put young people with all of their flaws and their pimples on the air. And they're going to make mistakes, but they'll learn quickly. They're going to outrage people. They're going to say the wrong things. They're going to play even CDs at the wrong speed. But if you want to get a young audience, you have to have young people talking to them. It just doesn't work the other way, no matter how much we'd like it to.
Yes, because you are, by the end of the book, you're getting on a bit there, Tim. How do you feel when you see young people doing similar things to what you did, making similar mistakes to the way you did? Do you try not to advise them, or you enjoy being a cranky old curmudgeon?
I try to push them further. If they think they're taking risks, they're not, because the true spirit of taking a risk is not to recognise that it is a risk at all. There are young people saying, yeah, we're really edgy. They're not. To think that you're edgy, you shouldn't think you're edgy. You should always think what you're doing is the absolute right thing that must be done right now, as opposed to, ooh, we're taking risks. Ooh, we're ruffling the hair of the old guys. Forget that. Get on air, seize the bandwidth, and make your own rules. That is what they're supposed to be doing, not getting permission from one commissioning editor or the other. Get on, use the bandwidth against itself.
Tim, let's finish with something musical. It could be something from the Doug Anthony All-Stars. It could be a part of a sketch. It could be something in your vast library of your own stuff. What would you like me to play at this point? Is there something of yours that has remained uncovered that we can play or something?
My favourite All-Stars song of all time is Krishna riding shotgun on the stagecoach of my life. It's just got a special piece of zing. So I'd be happy to use that as a stamp.
It's raunchy, it's blasphemous, and it's just plain wrong.
Only because it's still a great way to live your life.
Tim Ferguson, congratulations on Carry a Big Stick. It's been great to have been your friend and known you this long, and for the first time to be allowed into your house.
Oh, you know, I'm amazed we've survived. If you think about it,
and because we are Eskimo brothers, look that one up in Wikipedia, people.
So bizarre and yet so cruel and sad.
And here's Tim Ferguson to give his ringing endorsement to this current program you're now listening to. Over to you, Tim, in three.
Maynard, Maynard, Maynard. I'm Tim Ferguson, and I base my life on the teachings of Maynard.
Bless you, sir.
Set 'em up, break 'em down, pass the cup around. It's the lust we will share for quite some time. I've shaved my head, wear a dress, I've let my bunny wife. I've got Krishna riding shotgun on the stagecoach of my life. They're not as handsome as the Godhead whose skin is shining blue. My sweet Lord, Rama Rama, got my ticket to Nirvana. It's a commune, just left of County Cork. Share a pint with me, Lord Shiva, as we read the Bhagavad Gita. I'll have Krishna riding shotgun on the stagecoach.
are trying to make the pummies pay. We'll get Krishna and his shotgun to join the IRA.
On maynard.com.au. Hey, you!